So tonight we'll start with the last section of the fourth Satipatthana, the contemplation around the Four Noble Truths, which is conceivably an extended large topic, since that's the elephant's footprint, the whole of the Buddha's teachings, and everything is contained within it. So it's kind of interesting to figure out, well, what would be useful in terms of talking about it, in terms of it being a contemplation within the fourth Satipatthana. And first of all, the one thing that kind of struck me too, struck me also, was how Ajahn Jeff often refers to the holographic nature of all of these teachings, and this seems to be particularly a good example of one of them, because you have the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, and the Fourth Noble Truth, of course, is the Eightfold Path, and right mindfulness is part of the Eightfold Path, and the Fourth Satipatthana is the fourth part of right mindfulness, and the Four Noble Truths is the last contemplation. So the Four Noble Truths is contained within the Four Noble Truths. Just kind of keeps on going like that into infinity. And it's just a good example of the way all of these teachings, in many ways, they contain each other and they refer back to each other and feed back on each other. So it's not just a completely linear kind of a model. There's a lot of interconnection and playback with each other. In terms of a contemplation within this fourth Satipatthana, I was just thinking a bit about, you know, say the hindrances, the five hindrances and the seven factors that we've been talking about are generally good reflections to help cultivate samadhi. Of course, there's a lot of overlap in terms of insight as well, but that's kind of where they lean towards. And the contemplations around the five khandhas and the six sense bases seem to culminate in the development or the dispelling of ignorance and craving within the conditioned realm. And that this final, if you're kind of looking at it in a linear fashion, this kind of contemplation with the Four Noble Truths tends to hone in more on the characteristic of dukkha. And that as a culmination of Satipatthana practice, we're really looking at really understanding deeply the nature of dukkha and giving us a sense of it to the extent that it leads to the process of disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, and liberation. So that's how I've been kind of looking at it within the context of this particular Satipatthana, is that this is really the time where contemplation can really deepen around this characteristic of dukkha to the point of wanting to relinquish, to wanting to let go. And that, as we know, is the potential of complete contemplation of the Satipatthana. So what I thought I'd do for this first evening is just to read from the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, the section on the Four Noble Truths. As I think most everybody knows, the Satipatthana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya has, of course, the Four Noble Truths, but it's in a very abbreviated form. And the Satipatthana, Mahasatipatthana here in the Digha, has it in a much more extended form, several pages, quite a few pages worth, actually. But as I was reading through it, I was thinking, well, it's really just a really good contemplation. It really details all the aspects of what suffering is, defines a lot of the terms in relation to that, talks a whole lot about the different forms of craving, and then goes on to the third and fourth Noble Truths as well in some detail. So as I was reading it, I was thinking, oh, it also just makes, if your mind is kind of quiet and in a nice contemplative mode, then it just can be used as a reflection, as kind of a guide, almost a guided meditation. So, without further ado, I will read that last section of the Mahasatipatthana Sutta. The Four Noble Truths. Again, monks, a monk abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in respect of the Four Noble Truths. How does he do so? Here a monk knows as it really is, this is suffering. He knows as it really is, this is the origin of suffering. He knows as it really is, this is the cessation of suffering. He knows as it really is, this is the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering. And what, monks, is the noble truth of suffering? Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress are suffering. Being attached to the unloved is suffering. Being separated from the loved is suffering. Not getting what one wants is suffering. In short, the five aggregates of grasping are suffering. And what, monks, is birth? In whatever beings, of whatever group of beings, there is birth, coming to be, coming forth, the appearance of the aggregates, the acquisition of the sense bases, that, monks, is called birth. And what is aging? In whatever beings, of whatever group of beings, there is aging, decrepitude, broken teeth, gray hair, wrinkled skin, shrinking with age, decay of the sense faculties. That, monks, is called aging. And what is death? In whatever beings, of whatever group of beings, there is a passing away, a removal, a cutting off, a disappearance, a death, a dying, an ending, a cutting off of the aggregates, a discarding of the body. That, monks, is called death. And what is sorrow? Whenever, by any kind of misfortune, anyone is affected by something of a painful nature, sorrow, mourning, distress, inward grief, inward woe, that, monks, is called sorrow. And what is lamentation? Whenever, by any kind of misfortune, anyone is affected by something of a painful nature, and there is crying out, lamenting, making much noise for grief, making great lamentation, that, monks, is called lamentation. And what is pain? Whatever bodily painful feeling, bodily unpleasant feeling, painful or unpleasant feeling results from bodily contact, that monks is called pain. And what is sadness? Whatever mental painful feeling, mental unpleasant feeling, painful or unpleasant sensation results from mental contact, that, monks, is called sadness. And what is distress? Whenever by any kind of misfortune anyone is affected by something of a painful nature, distress, great distress, affliction with great distress, that, monks, is called distress. And what, monks, is being attached to the unloved? Here, whoever has unwanted, disliked, unpleasant sight objects, sounds, smells, tastes, tangibles or mind objects, or whoever encounters ill wishers, wishers of harm, of discomfort, of insecurity, with whom they have concourse, intercourse, connection, union, that, monks, is called being attached to the unloved. And what is being separated from the loved? Here, whoever has what is wanted, liked, pleasant sight objects, sounds, smells, tastes, tangibles, or mind objects, or whoever encounters well-wishers, wishers of good, of comfort, of security, mother or father or brother or sister, or younger kinsmen or friends or colleagues or blood relations, and then is deprived of such concourse, intercourse, connection, or union, that, monks, is called being separated from the loved. And what is not getting what one wants? In being subject to birth, monks, this wish arises. Oh, that we were not subject to birth, that we might not come to birth. But this cannot be gained by wishing. This is not what getting what one wants. In being subject to aging, to disease, to death, to sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress, this wish arises. Oh, that we were not subject to aging, etc., distress, that we might not come to these things. But this cannot be gained by wishing. This is not getting what one wants. And how, monks, in short, are the five aggregates of grasping suffering? They are as follows. The aggregate of grasping that is form, the aggregate of grasping that is feeling, the aggregate of grasping that is perception, the aggregate of grasping that is mental formations, the aggregate of grasping that is consciousness. These are, in short, the five aggregates of grasping that are suffering. And that, monks, is called the noble truth of suffering. And what, monks, is the noble truth of the origin of suffering? It is that craving which gives rise to rebirth, bound up with pleasure and lust, finding fresh delight now here, now there. That is to say, sensual craving, craving for existence, and craving for non-existence. And where does this craving arise and establish itself? Wherever in the world there is anything agreeable and pleasurable, there this craving arises and establishes itself. And what is there in the world that is agreeable and pleasurable? The eye in the world is agreeable and pleasurable. The ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind in the world is agreeable and pleasurable. And there this craving arises and establishes itself. Sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tangibles, mind objects in the world are agreeable and pleasurable. And there this craving arises and establishes itself. Eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, mind consciousness in the world is agreeable and pleasurable. And there this craving arises and establishes itself. Eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, mind contact in the world is agreeable and pleasurable, and there this craving arises and establishes itself. Feeling born of eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, mind contact in the world is agreeable and pleasurable, and there this craving arises and establishes itself. The perception of sights, of sounds, of smells, of tastes, of tangibles, of mind objects in the world is agreeable and pleasurable, and there this craving arises and establishes itself. Volition in regard to sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tangibles, and mind objects in the world is agreeable and pleasurable, and there this craving arises and establishes itself. The craving for sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tangibles, mind objects in the world is agreeable and pleasurable. And there this craving arises and establishes itself. And just, I thought that was interesting. You can crave the craving. Thinking of sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tangibles, mind objects in the world is agreeable and pleasurable. And there this craving arises and establishes itself. Pondering on sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tangibles, and mind objects in the world is agreeable and pleasurable. And there this craving arises and establishes itself. And that, monks, is called the noble truth of the origin of suffering. And what, monks, is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering? It is the complete fading away and extinction of this craving. It's forsaking and abandonment, liberation from it, detachment from it. And how does this craving come to be abandoned? How does its cessation come about? Wherever in the world there is anything agreeable and pleasurable, there its cessation comes about. And what is there in the world that is agreeable and pleasurable? The eye in the world is agreeable and pleasurable. The ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind in the world is agreeable and pleasurable. And there this craving comes to be abandoned, there its cessation comes about. Again, eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, mind consciousness, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tangibles, mind objects, eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, mind contact, perception, volition, the craving for all of these, the thinking and pondering on sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tangibles, and mind objects in the world is agreeable and pleasurable. And there, this craving comes to an end. There, its cessation comes about. And that, monks, is called the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. And what, monks, is the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering? It is just this noble eightfold path, namely, right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And what, monks, is right view? It is, monks, the knowledge of suffering, the knowledge of the origin of suffering, the knowledge of the cessation of suffering, and the knowledge of the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering. This is called right view. So there it is again, the Four Noble Truths contained within right view. And what, monks, is right thought or right intention? The thought of renunciation, the thought of non-ill will, the thought of harmlessness. This, monks, is called right thought. And what, monks, is right speech? Refraining from lying, refraining from slander, refraining from harsh speech, refraining from frivolous speech. This is called right speech. And what, monks, is right action? Refraining from taking life, refraining from taking what is not given, refraining from sexual misconduct. This is called right action. And what, monks, is right livelihood? Here, monks, the Aryan disciple, having given up wrong livelihood, keeps himself by right livelihood. And what, monks, is right effort? Here, monks, a monk rouses his will, makes an effort, stirs up energy, exerts his mind, and strives to prevent the arising of unarisen evil, unwholesome states, mental states. He rouses his will and strives to overcome evil, unwholesome mental states that have arisen. He rouses his will and strives to produce unarisen, wholesome mental states. He rouses his will, makes an effort, stirs up energy, exerts his mind, and strives to maintain wholesome mental states that have arisen, not to let them fade away, to bring them to greater growth, to the full perfection of development. This is called right effort. And what, monks, is right mindfulness? Here, monks, a monk abides contemplating body as body, ardent, clearly aware, and mindful, having put aside hankering and fretting for the world. He abides contemplating feelings as feelings. He abides contemplating mind as mind. He abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects, ardent, clearly aware, and mindful, having put aside hankering and fretting for the world. This is called right mindfulness. And what, monks, is right concentration? Here, a monk, detached from sense desires, detached from unwholesome mental states, enters and remains in the first jhana, which is with thinking and pondering, born of detachment, filled with delight and joy. And with the subsiding of thinking and pondering, by gaining inner tranquility and oneness of mind, he enters and remains in the second jhana, which is without thinking and pondering, born of concentration, filled with delight and joy. And those are his translations for piti and sukha, delight and joy. And with the fading away of delight, remaining imperturbable, mindful and clearly aware, he experiences in himself the joy of which the noble ones say, "Happy is he who dwells with equanimity and mindfulness." He enters the third jhana. And having given up pleasure and pain, and with the disappearance of former gladness and sadness, he enters and remains in the fourth jhana, which is beyond pleasure and pain, and purified by equanimity and mindfulness. This is called right concentration. And that, monks, is called the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering. So he abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects internally, contemplating mind objects as mind objects externally, contemplating mind objects as mind objects both internally and externally. He abides contemplating arising phenomena in mind objects. He abides contemplating vanishing phenomena in mind objects. He abides contemplating both arising and vanishing phenomena in mind objects. Or else, mindfulness that, quote, there are mind objects, is present just to the extent necessary for knowledge and awareness. And he abides detached, not grasping at anything in the world. And that, monks, is how a monk abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in respect of the Four Noble Truths. Whoever monks should practice these four foundations of mindfulness for just 7 years may expect one of two results, either arahantship in this life, or if there should be some substrate left, the state of a non-returner. Let alone 7 years. Whoever should practice them for just 6 years, 5 years, 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, 1 year may expect one of two results. Let alone 1 year, whoever should practice them for just 7 months, 6 months, 5 months, 4 months, 3 months, 2 months, 1 month, half a month may expect one of two results. Let alone half a month, whoever should practice these four foundations of mindfulness for just 1 week may expect one of two results, either arahantship in this life, or if there should be some substrate left, the state of a non-returner. It was said, there is, monks, this one way to the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and distress, for the disappearance of pain and sadness, for the gaining of the right path, for the realization of nibbana. That is to say, the four foundations of mindfulness. And it is for this reason that it was said. Thus the Lord spoke, and the monks rejoiced and were delighted at his words. So to me, that's just a very powerful contemplation. Obviously, the promise that even with just 1 week of practicing it, that one should attain arahantship or non-returner is based on a very thorough week of practice. And very, very deep penetration. There's a number of things that one could comment on. Just one thing that kind of hit me just as I was reading it was just as well that a reminder that even with this as a contemplation, the final step is also watching all of these aspects of this contemplation in their arising and cessation, and the letting go of them as also part of the conditioned realm, as even though they're probably the contemplation of this is just about the most skillful way one can abide in conditions, it still also is to be let go, relinquished for the realization of nibbana. But a pretty nice place to abide until that time. Any thoughts or reflections?
A question about right thought, because it's translated as right thought, samasankappa, but then the word sankappa doesn't really come up anywhere else. And like in Thai, it's kwam dhamri chop, and the word dhamri doesn't really come up that much in Thai language. So I wonder if there's any possible other ways of translating.
Well, Jeff translates it as resolve.
Right, resolve.
Dhamri is like to bring to mind. So that's a, it's kind of like bringing to mind.
So, intent, right, intention is sort of.
Intention is not quite right.
Yeah, because that word, no one thinks more like in terms of jaitana.
Yeah, so say. but because it's sanctified.
I think sometimes like the right, like what was the one I was, I often think of, like right attitude. Yeah, is something that often comes to my mind.
Yeah.
I think actually he comes up with a couple of others in his footnote. If I can find the right footnote. Samma sankappa, variously rendered as right aspiration, right motive, etc. Aspiration is kind of nice. It's more like right resolve, aspiration.
One thing about that, right intention, or is this, in Bhattacharya's beyond mindfulness in plain English, he identifies the vitaka vichara in the first jhana as wordless intention, as basically non-verbal, non-harming, non-ill will, and renunciation. And I don't know whether he's going, I don't know if that's something that comes from his book or whether he's going back to the commentaries. But that's, I hadn't heard that anywhere else, but it's an interesting interpretation.
It is an interesting. Yeah, hard to know. He's actually saying that the vitaka vichara in the first jhana is right intention.
Right, without words.
Without
words. But it's still.
To me, the. Way that Ajahn Chah often describes vitaka vichara is more of like the lifting up and application to any mental object that induces concentration seems to be. Because there's a lot of different objects that one can take into first, you know, as a basis for first jhana. Okay, 6:59. One more.
And I believe that in the Guakapong chanting book, one of the chants is the chant of the Eightfold Path from the Sutta. So Ajahn Chah chose that.
I know that Bhante Ji's chanting book has it as well. They chant that very regularly at Bhavana. I didn't know that Wapanana Chant had it.
There's some interest in reading. Very interesting. Sutta quotes that are translated in part of chanting. The Bhagavad Sutta. The Discourse on the Burden. Five kinds of being the burden.
Remember when I stayed at Bhavan Society, they pulled out some chanting, and one morning, near the end, it was really painful, and I could see my mind wanting to go into a fantasy, and I was like, oh yeah, right effort, you know, to prevent that, which is it is, and you could be just chanted, that, you know, came up and still do it, and afterwards I went over to, you know, came across, and I said, oh, this is great, you know, the chanting, you know, I hope my meditation, I don't even hear it anymore. You chanted it every day. And he said, when I was at a Bhagavad Gita, you were chanting. It's great. I was always reflecting on what I was chanting.
It's the way the mind is.
Yes. An unfortunate reality.
Okay.
Okay.